Recently, we were, many of us, at Ananda Village for our Spiritual Renewal Week, which happens every summer. Those of you who were not able to attend or missed some of those days, I highly encourage you to go onto the ananda.org website and look up the classes, because they were really well worth listening to. The theme of this particular Spiritual Renewal Week, it was the example and the teachings from the life of Swami Kriyananda, inasmuch as he passed away in April, and there's many stored up understandings, and this seems like an ideal time as the founder and the guiding spirit of Ananda for everyone to focus their energy more clearly on the gift of his life. As a consequence, there were many different speakers, and all of them, to varying degrees, had had long relationships with Swamiji, either very much in person or at a distance, but nonetheless, the example of his life was very vivid to them. I, of course, am in that number, having been associated with Swamiji since 1969, and by however you define it, he's been the center point of my life as a grown-up. I've never been a grown-up except with him there. And I was watching during this program mostly my peers, people I've known for 20 years at least, sometimes 30 or even 40 years, and each of them standing up and talking about, you know, what they have learned on the spiritual path, tying it to Swamiji or just in general to Master and to Kriya and to everything that we've done. And there was one just thought that just kept going through my mind as I watched 20 different people stand up and speak: depth and dignity. And hard-earned was also in my mind, partly because I would say I've grown up with these people. Even though we were physically adults before we met, we've all grown up spiritually. And we've had a lot of experiences together, some of them rajasic, some of them tamasic, some of them sattvic, on many different levels. So it wasn't only as I watched and felt the consciousness and heard the words and understood the wisdom that was coming forth. There was also this vibration, and that vibration was clearly the fruit of determined, unrelenting sadhana. Sadhana meaning spiritual practice. It involves more than just the practice of meditation. It's everything you do to bring your life into alignment with spiritual life. Sometimes I've had the opportunity to either answer questions or to speak on the subject, how do I find my spiritual path, of the choice of all the different gurus that there are and ways to practice, how do I know which one belongs to me? And I think it's very difficult for persons of our consciousness truly to evaluate someone whose consciousness is much greater than ours. I'm not sure whether this comes out of the Tolkien books or not, but the phrase I've heard is, beware of judging the actions of a wizard, because you never really know what the wizard might be doing. And I've certainly seen over the years that I had very close association with Swami Kriyananda, I rarely knew what he was really doing. And often only much, much later did I understand, because the way I have habitually viewed the world, and part of sadhana is to reverse that, is we tend to see the outward manifestation. And we have all these rules and ideas about how things are supposed to manifest outwardly. But one of the things that sadhana teaches us is that the only thing of lasting value is the inner consciousness that we have in the midst of whatever circumstances we're facing. And the difficulties that we face in life, as Master often said, it makes no difference what happens to us. The only thing that matters is what we become through what happens to us. So when Swami Kriyananda would be guiding or teaching people, just as he talked about his master before him, Paramahansa Yogananda, with whom he lived, he said, you really could not just take a superficial explanation of what was going on, because a person of elevated consciousness sees the karma. They see the direction of energy, or the false direction of energy, or the true direction of energy, and they're very little concerned with how the small events, even of one lifetime, happen if through those events, karmic tendencies that are the true source of our failure and our suffering are expurgated, are purged from us. I was listening recently to a story that Master used to tell about Swami Shankaracharya, who was a great sage from the past. And one of his disciples was a woman of great anxiety. She was always worried about everything. And he was urging upon her, her guru was urging upon her a certain action. And she said, but if I do that, I might die. Whatever it was seemed to feel like a real threat to her. And he turned to her and he said, die then. And she did, just right on the spot. She fell over. She was dead. And as Swamiji said in telling this story, there was no second chapter. There was no, oh, my child, now that you've learned, I'll resurrect you. No turning out that she wasn't dead. She was just dead. She was cremated. That was the end of that incarnation. Now, of course, he didn't kill her. He just, you know, was the voice for the karma to happen. It wasn't like he murdered her. But he wanted her to understand. And to him, the loss of one body and the end of one incarnation, if that false self-concern, anxiety could be purged, wouldn't it be worth it? It's so easy when it's someone else's life, isn't it? Especially when we never met her, right? And she's just a dim myth. We can say, yes, of course, that's how I would feel. But then when the slightest inconvenience comes to us, when our health is not exactly what we would want it to be, when our relationships don't work out exactly right, even more painfully, when the karma of people around us has to be played out and we're powerless to alleviate it, and we have to live through the rising to the surface of all these different variations that take us away from the one theme of bliss, then how difficult it is to remember, oh, die then. Because if you get over it, you will be over it forever. Part of the problem here is the illusion of time. It's very easy to imagine that if I can just feel okay now, I'll take care of the future when the future comes. We miss this obvious single fact that it's always now. And whatever I'm experiencing in this moment, if I manage to escape from it somehow now, I should say be rescued from it. It's just going to lurk out there in the bushes. And when it comes back, it's going to be just as poignant in that moment as it is in this moment. One of the most painful facts about suicide is not the idea that the person will be damned to hell or that God will exile them from the heavenly kingdom forever. No, and I don't mean to make this too pointed for those of you who've had loved ones who've died in this way. But what happens is you get to be brought to exactly the same point of suffering, except at some point you have to have the courage and the faith in God to go through it and realize that there is life on the other side of it. In other words, you just get to repeat the story. I find the concept of repeating the story to be a very powerful incentive. Extremely powerful incentive. If I'm not enjoying it now, I'm not going to enjoy it later. And having worked myself by great karmic effort over many incarnations into this particular conundrum that is now binding me and torturing me, why would I want to do all of that over again? Because that's all we get. Yogananda, Swamiji made an explanation of how you face karma, which is very important to remember. He says, he uses the phrase, meet karma at the crest of the wave of energy. The image that we always have is like this. If the problem is this big, and our normal consciousness is this big, the tendency is to try to get smaller. Like if you're trying to duck under a wave when you're swimming, you just try to get smaller and just hope that you can go around it. If instead we can rise mightily, perhaps to a level of understanding that we didn't even know we had, a level of grace that we can really hold on to and lift our energy up to the height of the crest of the wave, he said, then you get rid of the karma forever. Otherwise, what happens is it's the nature of a wave to gradually lose energy, isn't it? So if we're only this big and we hover out here until the wave is smaller than us and say, I've gotten over it, Well, we've gotten over it at a 3-inch wave. But what our karma really generated was a foot and a half, which just means that we're going to face it again, we're going to face it again, we're going to face it again. So the more powerfully we can draw upon that grace of God, and this is the secret that devotees begin to learn after a period of time, which is we are not alone in this effort, that there is always a conscious loving force. Our reading this week and our reading last week had a lot to do with Satan. But the other side of Satan, the other side of that dark habit, which constantly makes us think by contraction and by waiting to be rescued, that's the happiness I'll find. The opposite side of that is the power of the masters and their extraordinary dedication to help us. Yogananda wrote a poem, you know, where he talked about God's boatman and how his eternal commitment to all of those who seek spiritual refuge with him is to stick with us, to stay with us without fail until finally we reach the same state of freedom that he has. And his promise in that poem is, again and again I will come, a trillion times if necessary, with bleeding feet crossing crags of suffering. What a powerful poetic image. He's talking about himself. As long as one stray brother is left behind. Now, in our hour of need, and long before your hour of need, contemplate that. Contemplate what it means to have divine masters, whether you have given your heart to them as a disciple with a lifelong commitment, or whether it is merely just the beginning of a small doorway opening within you. Contemplate what that means. We can barely imagine, but think we know a little bit of it. All of us, I pray, have at least someone in your life for whom you feel you would do anything. Just to help them, your daughter, your son, your grandchild, your friend, your spouse, whoever that person would be, your karma has become so interlinked with them that you count it as nothing to give your life to help them. You know, the devotee, the renunciate, his determination is to serve God in any way that he can, but we learn first in the small ways. I remember a person in our community many, many years ago who was very, very difficult to get along with, very difficult, always self-concerned. Everything always came back to that person's concern. But that person had a child, and with that child, they were utterly selfless in giving. And Swamiji, and for this we thank him a million times, he always was able to pick out of any situation the one thread of light. And his answer was, he said, if that person can be like that with their child, that means they have it in them. They have it in them to be that selfless, and all it is a matter is of just cultivating and cultivating and cultivating. All of us as devotees, Swamiji has a philosophy that he always followed, go with your strengths. We have this wrong-headed thought and that we need to concentrate always on what's wrong with us, that we need to keep our focus on the things that are wrong. Well, all that does to us is just keeps reinforcing the idea in our mind that we are limited and that we are failures, and all of us are crummy in lots of areas. It's just part of who we are. Whether it's an important area or a small area, it doesn't make any difference. It's very, very easy to make a list of one's faults. It's just no genius involved. It's even easier to make lists of faults of all the people around you. No problem at all. Just give me a pen and paper and we'll all be here for a long time. But where does that take us? Master even gave this interesting advice, which I've always loved. He said, if a test is greater than you can pass, if you know that to confront that particular challenge will absolutely result in failure, failure of consciousness, failure of action perhaps, he said, run away. Don't you love that? I love having permission to do that. Run away. He said, because one, you don't want to reinforce the idea that you can't achieve it. And also it just builds in your mind the thought that when you try, you fail. And be assured, you'll get to face it later. Absolutely, promise. You'll get to face it later. But if it's more than you can handle, just move away from it. Because we don't want to always be emphasizing our weaknesses. Find that which you can do well or even adequately or better, however poor the actual measurement might be, and just flow with that energy. Because once we begin to feel what it's like to move with the rhythm of grace, to move in the power of the Spirit, to be able to call on inspiration and find it, then that becomes the way that we define life. And that becomes the way that we solve problems. I've mentioned to you before the peculiarity that Swami Kriyananda, in his attunement, I've always had a very mental attitude toward life, which I've been working my way through over these many decades. And when I first came to Ananda Village, I was assigned to the kitchen because I was very interested in nutrition and food. But it's a little hard to explain this, but I was so mental about it, I couldn't taste it. If it was supposed to be good, it was good. Except other people could taste it. And it always tasted very uninteresting. And I was one of the main cooks at that time for the whole community, and it was more than a small problem for them. Because at that time, people didn't have their own kitchens. They just had to come to the kitchen and eat what I would eat. And I thought if it was good for them, it was good. And they rebelled en masse and asked to be rescued from this problem of me. I didn't know this until later. And by that point, I could tell there was something wrong. I couldn't quite figure out what it was, but I could tell. And so Swamiji decided to teach me to cook. I might as well tell the whole story, although some of you have heard it. It was a weekend. He was having Swami named, who was called Swami Nirmalananda at that time. He's now become, I think, Father George. He's a big man who liked his meals three times a day. And he was visiting Swamiji for 3 days. And for 3 days, I stood next to Swamiji in the kitchen. We made food for him and for three or four others of us. On the last day, about the ninth meal, we were sitting on the floor. I have this picture of Swami Nirmalananda lying on the floor, so maybe we were just lounging on the floor. And Seva was there, and she said, "Oh, I'll cook supper." And Swami said, "Oh, that's good." And then he said, "No, he said it like this, I'm teaching Asha to cook," just like that. With this, I sort of looked at him with this peculiar, I didn't get it. And we went back up to the kitchen. We sliced fruit for fruit salad. I mean, this is how he taught me to cook. He never said a word. He never talked to me about the food. He never gave me any recipes, anything. He cooked very randomly. Oh, a little of this, a little of that. Oh, that's too much. Well, we'll balance it with this. And I was with a pen at the beginning, just trying to, just hopeless. But at the end of that time, I went back into the kitchen. I could taste the food, and I knew how to make it good. Honestly, to this day, I have no idea. He just somehow got inside my vrittis. He got inside my spine, and he just made them work for the sake of everyone else, really. I mean, they were very, very grateful for the change. But here's the part that I wanted to say. It was most interesting to me. From that point on, I began to understand how to be intuitive. And I began to learn how to be intuitive, not just about how to make the soup right, but just how to be intuitive. Swamiji had managed to find a place where he could put a little light in. It was a place of interest for me, and I was willing to put energy, but I wasn't quite there. Just a second, there's a little bit of a thought there. Oh, and I didn't have an egoic concern about it because I didn't think it was important. That was the point. If he tried at that point to teach me to write or to sing or to speak or anything like that in which my ego was deeply invested, I could never have heard him. But cooking to me, just because of the way I was raised and my intellectual orientation, was like that. So there was no barrier. But the point was the energy would flow. And if the energy flows in one place, then you can make the energy flow anywhere because you begin to know what it feels like. You can just sense it. And that is how we grow spiritually. Looking at all my friends over this last week, the days that I spent at Ananda Village, I know not only their successes, I have what you would have to call an annoyingly good memory for these things. I know not only all their successes, but all of their colossal failures. of which all of us, and I put myself right in the middle, we all have them. But it doesn't make any difference what happens to you. The only thing that matters is what you become through it. And what you become through what happens to you is not an attitude you save for the big one. Because if you're not in the habit of raising your energy and perceiving in whatever comes to you the power and the presence of God, then when the big one comes, there'll be no groove in your consciousness for you to do it. Every little minute of your life is the defining reality for the next minute. It's very important that we understand the simple cause and effect nature of how we got into this mess in the first place and how completely it is the result of every single little decision that we made. And the corollary of that is, you see, that we think it's a big problem to get out of it because we're looking only at this part of it and we look at ourselves as this big. But how do you get from here to here? You gradually stretch, don't you? And every time we make the decision that I may not be enjoying this, this may not have been my first choice. A friend of mine, his lung collapsed, and he was in the hospital with a collapsed lung, and I said, this is an admirable, but perhaps not the most effective way to go breathless. Maybe you should try one of the techniques instead, you know? But it's like, let's laugh. Let's consider it to be a cosmic joke. Instead of, oh, being so concerned, you poor thing, how much you're suffering. When I tell this story in my book about Swami Kriyananda, when Happy Winningham, who was a woman who lived at Ananda for a period of time, she died. She had AIDS. She was a very early person with AIDS. And eventually, and she had several very dramatic crises before she finally left her body. And one of them was she got spinal meningitis and was in the hospital, and she was really going out. I tell the whole story in the book. She was really going out, and nothing was going right, and there was this great sense of panic around the hospital, and she was lying in the bed, and somebody brought balloons in, and the balloons were looking like monsters on the wall, and her appendages were beginning to turn purple, you know, her face and her nose, everything was turning purple, and it was all just really dramatic. And somebody called Swamiji, and he came in, and he sat down next to her in the bed. And in the midst of all of this, he looks at her and says, Happy, you look, with that big red nose, you look just like Bozo the Clown. And in her delirium, she laughed. And then all of a sudden, other people laughed. And then suddenly the entire drama just turned into something else. As she put it, the nurse was able to find the vein, the administrator was able to find the insurance card. You know, just everything began to work. I mean, how audacious of Swamiji to be able to do that. But he knew, he looked at the picture, and he said, well, there's all this darkness and confusion. Let me just find one little piece of light and just pull it out. And as soon as then, everybody suddenly was back. Oh, yes, she'll live or she'll die. You know, but what difference does it make? It makes no difference what happens to us, only what we become through it. You know, as soon as you walk out of here and some tiny little thing happens, you can't find your car keys. You know, your car has a flat tire. Your cell phone battery has gone dead. The luncheon date that you expected to have is canceled. You get the notice that you've lost your job. You know, your best friend has died. Whatever it might be, because if it's not a minute after you go out the door, it's going to be 3 minutes after, or 3 days, or a year. But ask yourself, what matters in this situation? What do I have of lasting value but my consciousness? And a minute from now, what kind of consciousness do I want to have? And Divine Mother, help me. Beloved Guru, help me. Master, you promised on bleeding feet to come, and I may be that one stray brother, but you said you would come, and so there it is. You know, you can be Master's spoiled child. He described one of his disciples once as like a mouthful of hot molasses, too sticky to spit out, but too hot to swallow. And even though you think, oh, I don't want to, you know, be a problem to the guru, you're not a problem to the guru. He lives to save us. Think of the story in the Bible of the prodigal son. The worse we are, the more joyful the celebration when we finally turn to the light. Don't ever for one second imagine that God and Guru and all the masters and Swamiji now from the infinite are not only available to you, they're pressing against the limits of our ego with all their divine power, trying to open even a pinhole through which they can flood. Keep that always in mind, ever present in your mind, right in front of you. Divine Mother, naughty or good, I am your child, and you must redeem me. God bless you.